History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You're listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
The oldest they're all. She rocks all us children to sleep in her shawl. D is for Daniel, who tends to the door. He took care of Massa way back for the war. F is for Felix, who won't do no work. He's lazy and shiftless and ready to shirk. Z is for Zonia, chunky and small. But here come the missus, so I guess it's M.O.
Listen, Mammy, there ain't no way to wash clothes. What you all need is rhythm.
What do you all mean, rhythm?
I'll show you what I mean.
The Mammy, the Pickaninny, the Coon, the Sambo, the Uncle. Well into the middle of the 20th century, these were some of the most popular depictions of Black Americans.
Rumbly up there!
Rumbly up there. She rumbled, rumbled the knuckles, brought him down to the nub, yeah.
By 1941, when this cartoon was made, images like these permeated American culture. These were the images that decorated our homes, that served and amused and made us laugh. Taken for granted, they worked their way into the mainstream of American life. Of ethnic caricatures in America, these have been the most enduring. Today, there's little doubt that these images shape the most gut-level feelings about race.
When you see hundreds of them in all parts of the country persisting over a very long period of time, they have to have meaning. They obviously appeal to people. They appeal to the creator, but they appeal also to the consumers, those who read look at the cartoons or read the novels or buy the artifacts.
It's not just that it's in the figurines and in the, you know, the coffee pots and so on. It is that we are seen that way, perceived that way, even in terms of public policy. And that our lives are lived under that shadow. And sometimes we then even become to believe it ourselves.
Blacks don't really look like that. So why is it so appealing to people to think they look like that, and to pretend they look like that, and to like to look at icons that look like that? You look at them often enough, the black people begin to look like that, even though they don't. So that they've had a great impact on our society. They therefore tell us both about the inner desires of the people who create and consume them, and also they tell us about some of the forces that shape reality for large portions of our population.
Well now, children, tonight old Uncle Tom is going to tell you the real true story about Uncle Tom's cabin. Now, this is...
Contained in these cultural images is the history of our national conscience, a conscience striving to reconcile the paradox of racism in a nation founded on human equality, a conscience coping with this profound contradiction through caricature. What were the consequences of these caricatures? How did they mold and mirror the reality of racial tensions in America for more than 100 years?
Hotep, and greetings to you all, my sisters and brothers. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. We are here this evening by pure initiative and endurance. We have had an extremely very difficult time with the mechanical problems that have caused us not to be able to broadcast for two weeks, last week and the week before. Extreme difficulties. We could not get online. And today at the beginning at 8 o'clock, we attempted to try to do that as well, and we were not able to get online. So I was determined, along with our engineer, Brother Kwaku, to make this work. And so the reason you are hearing my voice now is because
this call is being recorded.
Pure natural endurance. That's the reason you are able to hear my voice right now. So we've had some very challenging things, and very clearly, I am so happy that we are able to be on the line and be able to broadcast here tonight. We had a very dynamic discussion that we wanted to do back 2 weeks ago, and somehow or the other, the forces that be were just not letting us do that. We want to talk about the whole ideology and the philosophy of blackface. We wanted to try to understand what history says, what our ancestors have told us about that, and just kind of look at some very interesting things that we can bring forward. So we are determined to do that, and we're going to cover a little bit of that tonight. We don't obviously will not have our full time, but to do it, so we're going to make this a part one, and then on next Tuesday we're going to do the part two. As I said, I am determined to have this discussion, and I'm going to have it in its full capacity. So we obviously started off tonight. We are here until 10 o'clock. We are here on every Tuesday night from 8 to 10. So we are now going into the top of the the second hour, and so we want to make sure that we are able to present all of the things that we want to say. I always like to begin every program with the words of the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey: one race, one aim, and one destiny. And that's why we're here. We're here tonight, and we're here each and every Tuesday night that we can get on the air, attempting to try to have discussions and dialogue that is very relevant to our people. So I want to get right into it, and hopefully that there are some folks that are able to join us. I did see someone log in, so hopefully we'd like for you to give us a call. This is a call-in format. Our telephones are working. The number is area code 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. I'd love to have you call and give some conversation to what we are doing. I think one of the things that has sparked the interest in having this discussion was what took place in Virginia back about 3 or 4 weeks ago with the uncovering of the blackface issue, and just some of the things around the country that have occurred along those lines. The clothing designer that decided to put a lynching a rope around his neck and put it on one of their T-shirts, Jesse Smollett, the brother from Empire, who claimed that he was a rope was placed around his neck and he was attacked, and somehow or the other, there may be some evidence saying that that wasn't true. So what is the motivation behind all of this ideology? Well, first of all, we know that racism in America is not dead. It has never died. It's always been alive. And there are many, many ways that we can look at it. I want to just simply say that this whole discussion, there is evidential facts that have been written about this topic. It's been written by our ancestors. It's also been written by Europeans as well. There are many books. There is a book that is called White Racism, A Psychohistory, by a psychiatrist by the name of Joel Cavell. That book kind of dialogues a little bit about where all this comes from. There's a book by a historian by the name of Winthrop Jordan called White Over Black that also details the whole history of racism. There's a book called The Black Image in the White Mind, where it takes a look at media and how the media has been used to mold and shape how white Americans see black folk, and then obviously what they do and helps them continue along the lines of their white supremacy ideas and movements and their white superiority feelings that they have. And so there's a lot of literature. Dr. E.E. Thorpe wrote a book called The Old South, A Psychohistory, where he deals with also some of those historical factors that play into why all of this is done. So the facts are there. We don't question that. We know that a lot of work has been done from different realms, from the psychiatric world, from the social world, the historical world, and looking at some of the documentations. I think one of the things that we want to look at, first of all, is that the system of chattel slavery in the English colonies, which began in 1619 with England. It does not begin slavery in America, in the Northern Hemisphere. It begins it in the English colonies, as we know. That's why I said 1619. That was one of the most horrendous systems of economics that there has ever been on the planet Earth. I think that is a no-brainer. We can go back and look at all of the different things that took place and the way the slavery was implemented. And then eventually that led to an economic system called chattel slavery, where all of the captives were property, and they were considered to be property, which then gave them no rights whatsoever over their own bodies. And as a result of that, some of the cruelness that we see and saw. And anyway, the idea is that this system had to be justified. Slavery could not have operated as long as it did, if you didn't justify it. And when we look back at the early development of the English colonies, as we look at what was called the French Enlightenment, when we look at some of these other philosophical areas at the time, we see their principles and ideologies that support of the inferiority of other races over European white people. And this whole idea is the beginning process. You have to remember, slavery was organized and put into place in the colonies by the church. It is the church that obviously that, and the church is a religious body, obviously professing that all men are created equal and that God made us all and we are all brothers and sisters. That wouldn't hold up in a way that would justify slavery. So what had to happen is using the Bible, using the philosophy systems, it had to be spelled out that the African was inferior and he was not human. Actually, that's basically what it was, is that he was a subhuman. So that's the root of all of this. That's where the roots begin. We're dealing with people that are not human. We're dealing with people who are feeble-minded and weak, and they don't operate in the same light as another human being. And so what we are going to do is we are going to capture them and try to make them human. And so in a sense, we are fixing to go about a humanitarian process. Slavery became eventually, as Europe developed itself, it became a humanitarian initiative. There were justifications that we are doing something for people. We are helping them become civilized. We are making them become Christians, and we are turning them into people. And so therefore, as the process begins, as the world is looking at England and they're beginning to do into the American colonies, we are looking at a humanitarian process. And we are looking at it because these folk are not human. And so what was done is that that had to be backed up as well. And so you had to do it through science. You had to do it through religion, sociology, and all of those forms of disciplines of study had to be able to rectify a way of saying what it is that Europe is doing. And in doing that, it paints an ugly picture, obviously, for Africans. Africans, basically, and Africa itself was invaded. It was an act of warfare. The Africans went into, the Europeans went into Africa and they invaded that land. They uprooted the people. They took them out of their native soil and attempted to plant them in another soil and have them live and operate as though it was their own. And that was just not possible. And in doing that, they created ugly images and talked about ugly images in ways that would definitely demean and justify why is it that we need to do this. And if you were ever to take a look sometimes and read some of that literature, and it is available, a lot of it is still around, a lot of it is in archives, a lot of it is books that you can, rare books, but there are books like The Negro or Beast. There's a book that was done very similar to that, and it's saying that obviously the African does not come from the Adamic family, and that it was, it said, the book goes on to explain that there were three things in the Garden of Eden on the morning of creation. There was Adam, there was Eve, and there was a snake. And they paint a picture of the Adam, which is obviously being a white, straight-haired male, or Eve, a white woman, and then a snake wrapped around a tree, which was black. And so the writer, whose name was John Carroll, said in that book, he said, now, here's Adam, here's Eve. Where's the Negro? So he must be a snake. And began to logically attempt to explain in that book that he was not a part of the Adamic family. And so as a result of that, we don't have any responsibility to do anything for a creature like this. God did this out of a freak of nature. So it's that kind of beginning knowledge that develops around the slave trade that obviously is justified. And so a lot of the explorers and those who were involved in the building of the colonies were people who believed in this type of ideology. They believed in this kind of development. And so obviously, as they drew pictures and as they began to talk about slavery and some folk talked about ending it and things like that very early, negatively, that would not happen, because we've got another image, we've got another ugly picture of being able to do that. And so as a result, this is branded into the fabric, into the life of the development of the English colony. This is threaded into that. The Constitution, as it's beginning to be developed, acknowledges right up front the whole idea of slavery and being a legitimate and legal institution. I recall the reparations movement was attempting to sue England over reparations. This was a recent occurrence. And England said that the only way that would be considered that they did anything wrong is that if slavery would have been illegal. And so they argued that we didn't do anything wrong because it was a legal system. It was sanctioned by the courts, it was sanctioned by the church, and it was sanctioned by the community of people. So what did we do wrong? We were doing what was legal. Now, it may not have been ethical, but the ethics of the time did not make it a law. And so this is the beginning of what we see. This is branded into the psyche of Europe, especially coming over into the colonies. This is a branding process that has taken place. And it's basically very difficult mentally and psychologically to erase that kind of behavior and attitude. Now, there is this discussion very clearly that that this system did not affect the Africans and subdue them to this whole process. There's a whole historical argument and discussion is that were they slaves? Were they captors? Is it incorrect to call them a slave? Is it incorrect to be able to say that they had fallen captive to this system? Well, I think you have to look a lot of times at the fact that, number one, the African never surrendered to this. They always fought back. They waged the war, and they attempted to respond to this from day one. And there's lots of history about the rebellions that took place. Nobody was going to give in to this kind of system. But obviously, from the European perspective, it would be much better if you can argue that they wanted to do this, that they wanted to be on the plantation, that they were happy, that they were good darkies, that they sang songs all day, and they laid around and ate watermelon. And these are all these things that were done to try to show that we are not doing anything wrong. Because, like I said, it has to be justified. One of the major individuals that questioned the whole system of slavery very early in its beginning was a French writer, young guy, named Alex de Tocqueville. De Tocqueville indicated that this was not a good system. And he wrote a book called On Democracy. And he questioned that. He questioned the penal system. And he questioned the English. And the English definitely did not want to be looked at by their neighbors, the French and so forth, even though the French involved themselves in slavery as well. But still, in terms of their philosophical idea, they wanted to soft pedal the whole system. And so they attempted to try to do that in many, many ways. There was some of our ancestors who came along around by that. There's a man by the name of Alexander Crummell. Crummell was a philosopher, and he was arguing this whole ethics about superiority, inferiority of Africans, and he was doing it from their perspective. He had been trained, obviously, in European universities, and he was using the philosophical principles to argue that that this system was incorrect. And so a lot of folk were doing that. My thought is that just the mere idea that you are arguing whether slavery is right or wrong is a problem. Because when you read and look at what took place in that system, you obviously know that there's no question about what's right or wrong. You don't treat a human being, I don't care who they are, what color they are, where they came from, in that way. We also realize, as we talk about it, and what I'm doing is looking at how this ideology is branded into the thinking and how it's going to be very difficult to take it out, to do away with it. You can't write an amendment and end it, and people don't support it in a way. You can't legislate this out of people's thinking. You can't legislate this out of the community. Old Dixie is still Dixie. It hasn't changed. Those Southern South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi congressmen and senators are still the same way they were in the 1600s to 1700s. It hasn't changed. The ideology is the same. The words are a little bit softer, but it's the same thing. You know, and so let's get that part straight, is that you can't legislate that kind of evilness by writing a document or either by passing some rule or law or say something about people are now free. You know, that's insane to even begin to think about it. And so what we have to look at and what we have to be assured of when we start seeing these images and these incidents happening, it almost seems as though we are expecting Europeans and Caucasians to do better. But it's not. It's in their soul. It's in their bones. And even though there are people saying, well, I'm not racist. I ain't never been racist. No, it's not that way on a conscious level. But down in there somewhere is the genes and the behavior of your great-great-great-grandparents. And you don't even really have to go back that far. You can go great-great, the lynchings, the Knight Riders, the Ku Klux Klan, and all of those things that happened, you know, in the early turn of the 20th century are still a part of that. And so when we see things like blackface, when D.W. Griffin created The Birth of a Nation, he was spelling out just the whole ideology of what white people saw when they look at a black person, and when they look at a black man, when they look at a black woman. That's what they are just simply spelling out what they saw. One of the things through the race mixing, you know, you began to get this mulatto class that comes in. In some cases, that was kind of done and designed to make it a little bit more palatable to be able to look at black people and to deal with black people. But for many years, we struggled with when we were not raced and mixed ethnically with other folk. Those images, again, were harsh. They said we looked like the orangutan. There was a book written by a slave owner out of Jamaica called The History of Jamaica. And he said that black folks looked like orangutans. And he said that they probably could be bred with orangutans and that we should do so. If you get an opportunity, take a look at that book. It's called The History of Jamaica. And it was written as an ugly book, and it talks about some of those kinds of things. But this is the way they thought, and always equated us with the monkey and the gorilla and the ape. They said we were just one stage from that. And so we want to make sure that people understand that how it is that in 2019, you could have somebody that would attempt to play an image like blackface and say that that's acceptable. It can't. So the governor of Virginia, who is representing one of the hardcore slaveholding states, you know, of the Americas, one of the first of the English colonies, and he made reference to that even in his interview with CBS. He says that we are the home of Jamestown, Virginia. 1619, 400 years ago. He said, we just celebrated our name. Well, what they celebrated the anniversary of the enslavement of African people and the ugly and harsh treatment they were served. Now, I noticed when he, in that interview, he called them indentured servants. Well, that's questionable. And I understand that I know historically and in the history books that has been said that they are indentured servants. There may be some other questions about just what that was. And if you look at the research, there are some others that have argued that that's not the case. They were in captivity when they came over here into Jamestown, Virginia. And they were treated in that way. And never was there going to be an attempt to honor their indenturism. That was just not going to happen. But anyway, that's what we've been told and historically, and I think that a new breed of historians will begin to write a better story of exactly what happened in Jamestown. We did find recently in some material in archives the fact that Jamestown was very cannibalistic. There was a lot of cannibalism going on in Jamestown, Virginia, and that people were starving, and the Native Americans had cut off the supply of helping the English because they were ugly and they had begun to do some ugly things. And so they backed away, and so a lot of them starved. And so what they did is they ate each other. And cannibalism was openly practiced, as we know by then. But again, the Africans that were involved were obviously never set free. Some were able to move into other parts. There was one African that ended up owning property and doing some things in sales, but that didn't happen on a large scale. And then as the slave ships began to come into the Americas and landing in Baltimore and New York, the Dutch got involved. The Spanish were involved. The Portuguese, the early beginners, the Spanish, the French, the Dutch, and then obviously the English were the last. Supposedly up until the 13th Amendment. But anyway, they were bringing in Africans daily, packing those ships, 300, 400 people, depending on the ship, tight pack, loose pack, and day after day after day after day, America was being bombarded with people in captivity. Ugly images that they talked about. They wrote things about it that's available for you to reading. And that never went away. And I think that's what we have to see. We would want to say that the Emancipation Proclamation, which didn't end slavery, but the 13th Amendment, which did not end slavery either way, it only ended the chattel piece of slavery, very clearly was still there. So as we moved into the end of the 18th century and to the 19th century and then on into the 20th century, all of those ideas, logic systems, just went forward with all of that. So it did not change. And so when we see in early America, and we start seeing the lynchings, and we start seeing the minstrels and all of those, these are just ideologies and principles and ideas just being carried over from all of those years. I think one of the things that you look at also is that African Americans began to take on those images as well on a volunteer basis, began to use it as a way of supporting themselves. When we look at New Orleans particularly, and we talked about that in some of our promotional ideas of the program, is to look at, for instance, the Mardi Gras. And the Mardi Gras was always a big festival, an idea where a lot of the buffoonery of Africans were placed on parade. And that was because New Orleans was the trading capital of slavery. So you had down there in the French Quarter, where that French market is, that's trading, that was a slave market. And so a lot of those images were there, have always been there. And so a lot of those caricatures that you see, like the salt and pepper shakers, the Aunt Jemima, Uncle Ben, and all that stuff, they still selling those down in the French market right now. You can go down there and buy you a salt shaker of Aunt Jemima and the Uncle Ben type image, and it's there. And so, as again, it's, and people buy them, and a lot of times African Americans buy them, and it's bred it, as I said, into the mindset of that. You have to ask yourself a question. What is it about a box of pancake mix that by putting a black woman on it, you can make people buy it? What is the psychology of that? What is it that, that General Mills, in terms of their marketing, refused to take that image off? Because they said if they take that image off that box, it will kill their sales. So what is it about a box of pancake mix that would make people buy it if there's a black woman on the cover? This is the psychology of this time period. What is it that does that? What is it about a black man holding up a tray of rice that would make you say, oh, I want that rice. I don't want this rice. I don't want this Carolina rice. I don't want this one. I want this Uncle Ben's rice. And answering that question helps you to understand the damage that all of this history that had been used to justify slavery did in America. We forced our children to read Little Black Sambo. We forced them to learn the alphabets using these caricatures. We were forced to deal with the stories of Uncle Tom's Cabin and all of that imagery stuff. And we did it at our own children. I remember in my school, I went to school in the segregated South, reading Little Black Sambo. And I used to be always fascinated as how did they turn the pancake mix running around a tree. And there were postcards that used to be sent of little black kids being eaten by alligators, or sitting around on the front porch eating watermelon and seeds. These were postcards that people would send who came from the north down to the south to visit. They would buy postcards and send them back to their friends in the north saying, I'm down south having a good time. And it was like secondhand. It wasn't done to demean from their perspective. It was just, this is the south. And so I think that is what we have to look at, and that too is not gone. That's still around. Aunt Jemima is still on the pancake box. Uncle Ben is still on the rice. Now they fixed him up a little bit. I think Aunt Jemima has a perm now. They took the head rag off her head, She's a little bit dressed up, but she's still on the pancake box. I remember when Miss Butterworth, Syrup, came out. Miss Butterworth was a black woman. And then the complaint again came so high that they changed her to a white woman. So if you look at the Miss Butterworth Syrup jar, it's not that heavyset Aunt Jemima figure. It's a little bit more of a slimmer, but it's a white woman on there. That was not the way it started out. She was a black woman. And they will put her on the jar using that imagery to sell. And they did it to sell everything. They sold toothpaste. They sold, there was a term, there was a product that they used to sell that were made from Brazil nuts. Brazil nuts, as you know, are hard shell nuts, and they have a curve. Well, in the South, and I'm going to use the word, in the South, they were called nigger toes. And you would go to the store and say, give me 2 pounds of nigger toes. Well, that means that you wanted 2 pounds of Brazil nuts. And they were dark brown, and they kind of looked like that. And so these were natural things. This is, nobody would say, give me 2 pounds of nigger toes and start laughing. They just said, give me 2 pounds of nigger toes. Everybody knows that that's Brazil nuts. Oysters were sold with names and a lot of other peanut products were always sold using the name of black folks. Snuff and tobacco was used with black folk names because, again, the old Dixie, the old South, the Magnolia Tree, the Mississippi River, all of these are memorabilias that generate wonderful thoughts about being in good old Dixie. I remember in the South, and during the years that as coming up, the television stations used to go off at night. They would go off at 12 o'clock. I remember they didn't play the Star Spangled Banner like they did. They played Dixie. And that was a part of the memory. That was a journal article that was written by a historian named Eugene Genovese. He wrote it, and he talked about the Moonlight and Magnolias, and obviously that being a very major part of Southern living. And when you say that, it makes you just think of the good old times down South. The Camp Town races, my old Kentucky home, all of those was things that were done to make you think about how wonderful it was living in the South and how being down there was just a place of joy and peace. And that kind of life was done. To this day, Ted Turner still plays Gone with the Wind. The Turner Network plays the Gone with, now they've even gone so far as to remaster it and put it into living color. I mean, sophisticated living color. And so you now look at Gone with the Wind from a technicolor perspective. And the roles that Black played in those things, Hattie McDaniels and some of the others that played in that were awful. The early beginning of television with Jack Benny, Rochester, Yasser Boss, Stephen Fetchit, Amos and Andy. We know those images. Those were things a lot of times we looked at. A lot of times we used to look at the Jack Benny show because we get to see somebody black on TV. You didn't see them anywhere else unless they played those roles. But I personally have a problem with all of that. I have a problem, and I understand that Rochester probably made a lot of money. I understand that Burt Williams was one of the richest entertainers in the world by playing blackface and being able to participate in the Ziegfeld Follies. But I'll be honest with you. I think he sold himself out, and he sold himself to his sold his people out by participating in some garbage like that. The same argument that you would make saying that he was just making money. He needed to make money. He wanted to make money. That same argument could be made for a drug dealer that sells drugs in your community. He's trying to make money to feed his family. You can go on and argue all that thing. So I'm doing what I can do just to make money. I would not want to make money painting my face black, white lips, just to be able to say that I needed to make the money. I'll find another way to make the money. And I'll have to learn to live a little bit more of a simple life as opposed to allowing myself to be exploited and used like that. Stephen Fetchett, the actual person that played that role in Stephen Fetchett was a very sophisticated, straight-up kind of black man. He was well-spoken, and he did not reflect any of that he played. The lazy, yeah, Mr. Boss, you know, that was not his character, but he did that. And he made a lot of money. He was rich. And he did well by playing and taking on that role in that. So I have a problem with that. I have a problem with him selling himself out, selling his people out for the sake of money, because we get that same thing today. We have entertainers who are prepared to do anything, play any kind of role. That's why I'm so appreciative of some of the ones that did not bow, like Cicely Tyson. She basically stayed to straight up roles and refused to play all kind of character. The Academy Awards just went off. There were people, the first Academy Award for Best Actor and Best Female Actress went to an ugly sister. And I love Denzel. I like the roles that he played, but that character he played in that movie was ugly. Now, would I have done that? I don't know. I doubt it. I would not have wanted to betray that. And I know he played the part. He did it well. I'm sorry. You know, I'll take my beating from anybody that says you're wrong. But I just wouldn't agree to that. And then what Halle Berry had to do in that picture, in her role in the movie, was just unconscionable in terms of how she had to allow herself to be used to that southern white man who killed her husband and who sat around and disrespected her community people and did all some of the things that Billy Bob Thornton did in that movie. I don't know. I'm not with that. So I'm gonna see if some of our guests, we have a few guests that are online, see if they would have a comment about this. As you know, this is a shorter version. We're going to come back next week because I did have somebody that was coming on as a guest, but we've had to cancel so many times. Again, thank all of you who are on now for your patience. It was just been very difficult technical problems, and I think we might have this one licked. I have Comcast as a carrier. They came out over the weekend and fixed this internet system. It had been down for about a week, and they did fix it. Seems to be working okay now. And then there was some mechanical problems within the console that we use to broadcast. So that seems to be straight. Our engineer helped me download a more fresh model of it, and so we used that. So hopefully we're going to be okay. And so that's one of the reasons why we haven't been on and why this program has been on real short. But I'm gonna open up the lines, and I always got my good brother here, Brother Timothy, see what he's got to say. I talked to him earlier today. We were talking about all the different stuff that's going on, and we've got a lot of news that's consistently happening around this whole racism stuff. But, Brother Timothy, you got anything you might want to say or add to this discussion?
Oh, yes, sir. I'm going to say to you, Dr. Rogers, I'm hoping and I was praying and it wish came true that you came through, because I miss you on Tuesdays, man.
Yeah,
I really do.
That's right. And I thank you for your patience. Yep.
I'm going to tell you, Dr. Rogers, I'm going to start with who is the original man and not who was, who is. If white people were the first people on the planet, they would never let you live it down. They would have flags in front of their house. They would have it on tags. They would have it when they go swimming. They would have it on their trunks. They would have it on tattoos on their skin. They would never let you live it down if they were first.
Right.
It became so bad that when Charles Darwin came around, he said, "You know, I'm going to knock Africa and Egypt being in Africa. I'm going to come up and say that man came from space, amphibian, reptiles, and then man came from apes, and then he evolved, just to take us away from Africa. And I'm going to say, just as you talked about the Auntie Mama with the rag, and she goes from that to straightening her hair, one thing that, when it came to markability, one thing that Barry Gordy had realized, he said, in order for me to sell my albums, on the Temptations album, he put Superman on there. He reversed it. He said, in order for whites to buy my albums, because if I put the Temptations' five black faces on that album, they won't buy it. So he reversed it and put Superman on there. Mm. So Dr. Rogers, we're going to have to somehow reverse the psychology and turn it back around to make us original. Elijah Muhammad did a good job of breaking the psychology of the white man that was in the black man and woman's mind.
Yeah.
So
true.
Dr. Rock, I'm giving an example. In other words, what he did is that he gave Malcolm an X. He gave Lewis an X. He gave Jeremiah an X. And with that, he said, your name is unknown. You know, we are so psychologically affected by racism, Dr. Rogers, mm-hmm. by our name being Timothy. And some people say, well, if my mother named me James and Martin, Matthew, and Luke, I'm keeping that name. And they may be Afrocentric. And they're so embedded with that, that because she named me that, and my father named me that, I'm not getting away with that.
Right.
But a person who liberated himself was Kwame Ture. That shows you where his mind,
that's right.
That says a
that's
lot,
right.
how we are affected by racism. To change your, to bring you back to your culture, your name, your country, and your flag.
Mm-hmm.
That right there tells you how we are so, you have people Afrocentric, Islamic, about the Caribbean. And if you come after them about their name, well, my mother named me, my father named me that. And that's the slave master's name.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right.
That's how bad we are affected. Let me give you another example, Dr. I'm going to give somebody else a chance. That governor in Virginia, he talked about indentured service. Dr. Rogers, he knew that we were over here since 1555.
Right.
See, that all that stuff is so hidden that he could say to you that I'm not racist, Dr. Rogers. Just because he's a Democrat, it just goes to show you that a Democrat who claims to be liberal, passing legislation that he says is liberal, is really a racist. And like you said, Dr. Rogers, we are so affected by that, by not thinking, oh, he wants to moonwalk like Michael Jackson.
Yep.
And an attorney general does CODIS blow. Dr. Rogers, you mean to tell me a man in graduate school, you and I have been in graduate school, concentrates on us?
Right.
They are that affected, and they are so intimidated by us that they got to put all that in their mind to make us look inferior. They feel that insecure. That's the white man's problem. He got a God complex, the last poet said.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That's
bad.
Powerful. That's powerful.
Bad.
And you're right about that. And you're right. And that we're talking about change for ourselves. And
we
can't begin to address change without doing it first in a psychological perspective. We've got to change there. You know, we've got to begin to do that inside of us and pass that on to our children.
We're given signs.
Uh-huh.
And we are given signs all the time. And we run away from our leaders. I give a perfect example. Who should have won Best Picture? Many Oscars is Spike Lee with Black Klansman.
Yeah.
See, he took and reversed that. And people can't dig it. They can't understand it.
Right.
He's so much ahead and far the game. He may have a little arrogance about him, but he's so far ahead in the game, Dr.
Yeah,
Rogers,
he always has been. He always has been. Yeah, he's got a definite consciousness in terms of his filmmaking that has always been out there in the front. Starting even with School Days, I think in the movie She's Got a Habit, he was making a serious statement in that movie. But very
Everything
clearly,
he's ever made,
School Days.
I would give it. I was, you know what? You can't even compare to Tyler Perry. It's a different filmmaker and a production artist like Spike and a Tyler Perry.
Mm-hmm.
It's a difference in him and he's like.
Oh no doubt
Spike
about
is like our Bergman or Scorsese. He
right.
is our Scorsese. Mm-hmm. He does quality, not quantity. Quality.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Different.
And I love James Brown. I love James Baldwin. I love his work. But that book, if Bill Street could talk, that book, it does address some cultural things that relate to us. But I think right now we're in a time frame that we need to see some stronger factors come forward. Now, I'm not taking anything away from Baldwin because I like Baldwin.
No,
you know,
of course.
But I'm just talking about the way that was had been viewed, and the way it was being looked at in terms of the production. So I don't want to get to it. I don't want to get into it right now in this discussion. But there are some issues that I think at some point we want to have a discussion on that because it needs to be brought up, and what it may very well have a lot to do. Like for instance, with the Smollett case, with the brother from Empire. Empire has not been a production, I think, that's wholesome for the black community. I would not want my children to watch Empire. There are some problems.
Well, not only that, Doctor, but I would say also Star. Lee Daniel also did Star, which the production that came behind it.
And that comes on prime time. That comes on prime time. That comes on when kids are still up.
That's right. And Dr. Rogers, European promotes that and doesn't mind that type of activities. Just like the unclean rap.
Right.
You got clean rap, you got unclean rap. He'll push the unclean rap.
Exactly.
And he'll push Lee Daniel stuff, but yet you can't. But they won't let Spike Lee have a series like that.
Okay.
Let Spike Lee have a series like that on black consciousness.
Exactly.
Less.
Yeah, so there's some stuff going on, and we know that. Now, see, here's the problem that I have. A lot of times we run away from talking about it. We don't want to talk about it, and we back away from it.
Right.
But it needs to. It has to be talked about, whether you like it or don't like it, or whether you make somebody mad or don't mad, because it's affecting the children, the family. That's the problem. It's the family, the children. You and I are old. We can have it. But that's it. Well, Brother Timothy, let me go over here to one other person because we're going to be off the air in about 15 minutes. Sister 336-621.
Yes, greetings, Dr. Rogers.
Yes, ma'am. Greetings. How are you doing today?
Peace. How are you?
How are you?
Okay. I got to tell you, the ancestors are just working tonight through you. They're speaking through you tonight.
Uh-huh.
I could hear in the beginning when you talked about the determination that you had to get this on.
Oh, yeah, I had to.
Oh, the ancestors right behind you, because everything you said was so on point. I was just like, I want to record this. Well, I'm sure I can go back and listen to it. But let's just make sure that we can listen to this after the show, because you just hit everything on the head so powerfully. I got to say that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to make a couple of points.
Okay.
You talk about the caricatures and whatnot when you were playing Ethnic Notions, Forces of Ethnic Notions in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
Here in Greensboro, I showed that video to mostly the members of the Nation of Islam here, and everybody was so blown away, you know. And to see how the European their pathology, to see how it plays out in all the things that they do via the media, to make sure that they teach and reinforce black inferiority. They go through so many lengths, and so that history is something that our people really need to understand, because when we, as you always talk about history, when we see that history, now we can see it, not only read about it, but see it. You can see it playing out in today.
You
can see it playing out. Those images, of the mammy and the big exaggerated lips and all of that stuff, you know, it's seared into our mind.
You see it today.
Today, absolutely. And then you have people like, you know, I don't know half these entertainers' names, but Kevin Hart, the ones that are are still kind of cooning and acting.
Yes.
You know, they just reinforce all of that nonsense, and it does. It has a tremendous impact on young people because they want to do that because you can make some money.
That's right.
You know, and they're willing to do anything now, and it comes from all of that. You ain't nothing but a caricature of whatever we say you are that gives our young people the mindset that we'll just do anything for money.
That's right.
Well, we don't mind being looked at like idiots and morons.
Yep, that's right. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it's very, very powerful. I want to make one other point. When you said niggatos, I swear I was thinking about that at the same time that you said it.
Really? Okay, yeah.
The same exact time when you made some comment, and then I said, oh, I hope he talks about the niggatos. And then you said niggatos.
Right.
Because I remember that during Christmas, my father would say, give me one of those niggatos.
Yeah, that's right. And they would actually go to the store and say that. Can I have a pound of niggatos, please?
That's all I knew. I didn't even know the real name until I became a teenager.
Right, that they were Brazil
nuts. I thought they were called niggatos.
Right.
That's how easily you can brainwash someone, and that's what people don't understand.
Right.
It's so easy to brain dirty. Just repeat the same crazy thing over and over again. That's why our young people and some elders still call each other niggas.
That's right.
And they hold on to it for dear life.
Talking
and if you try to get them to stop saying it, they'll kill you.
Talking about it's a term of endearment. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the twisted thinking that arises from all of this sickness that we've internalized.
Right, that's exactly
right. That's all it is. So we perpetuate this stuff from generation to generation. It's pathetic. And I want to say one more quick thing.
Uh-huh.
I really, really plan to start talking about black folk just moving away from this whole entertainment industry.
Yeah.
Because they've just been exploiting us ever, you know, from the beginning.
Yep, it's being coded into that. You're exactly right. Yes. Yeah, looking at
and we're just being exploited. The continuous perpetuation of brainwashing through entertainment.
That's right.
And you know, if we were to make a decision to start to move away from that and more into things like becoming doctors and et cetera, scientists, et cetera. Not only will we move away from that level of exploitation that, you know, messes everybody's mind up on some level, but we can also practice what Minister Farrakhan talked about with economic withdrawal.
Right.
It could be very beneficial for us to move away from that, but it'll be like asking us to pull all our teeth out.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. You got it.
Thank you so much. This is very powerful.
Thank you. I'm going to go over here to area code 646. 626. Good afternoon, caller.
Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Hey, how you doing, brother? How you doing?
I'm doing good, man. It's good to hear your voice and hear you
doing your
thing as always. I just wanted to call in and say hello to you.
Thank you so much.
How you doing?
Yes, indeed. Appreciate it. Thank you. Always want your input. Always love your input.
Well, I always enjoy listening to you when I get an opportunity to. I see you were talking about Hollywood and the shenanigans of that whole industry. But, you know, the thing is, we as a people are always looking to be a part of a system and look for acceptance. And whenever they give us any type of acceptance, it's really not of high character.
Right.
It's of low character. You know what I mean? So when you get someone that gets an award and, you know, they don't celebrate, let's say, Wakanda, or they don't celebrate the other Mystical Negro movie, but give it to the so-called buddy-buddy integrationist movie like The Green Book, you know, it just goes to show you. I mean, and then on top of that, then they disrespect you by not even mentioning the person who was the central figure of the movie. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's just blatant disrespect any way you look at it. And unfortunately, because we need heroes, we don't call it out or don't even say anything about it. You know, so, I mean, It didn't do nothing for me.
No, nothing.
Because
nothing.
Someone got an Academy Award. Does it change the condition of our people?
Nope.
No, it's not going to change the condition of our people. It's not going to do anything to make our lives that much better. It's not going to even put us in a position to see honest displays of our culture.
Right.
So,
that's right.
I mean, it's just another way to get your dumb behind to go give them your money when some movie comes out that has the representation of you.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, hey, man, it is what it is. Eventually, the people will wake up and see it for what it is. But quickly, I want to ask you a question because we haven't had a chance to really talk or anything.
Okay.
What's your take on this DOS mess that's going on?
Say it again. On which one?
What is your take on the DOS nonsense that's going on?
Yeah, I was just reading some stuff on that today, and it appears that it was a front to slip in some other kind of agenda, and that it really wasn't. I mean, that what does it stand for? It stands for something about
African descendants of slavery. Or African descendants of slaves,
right.
Descendants of slaves. You know, it depends on what, you know, they want to use it to put forward whatever agenda it
right.
is.
And there's supposed to be somehow or the other way to funnel some money into some other movement. And it really doesn't, nothing goes to actually for the community or for the people. And so it's a front to do something.
Well, let me just put this out, and I want the listening audience to be clear of this.
Okay.
The people that are ahead of the movement, any money that you've given to them, they put it in their pocket.
Right.
It doesn't have a charitable contribution behind it. It's going in their pocket. So I can't trust it.
Right.
Because I'm not donating to no Negro that I can't get a tax write-off. Even though basically Trump done took that away from us, but to be in the situation to just give money to put into some lesbian woman in some arrogant Negro pocket. You know, if you want to give an arrogant Negro some money, get the money to me.
Right. Right. Exactly.
You know?
Right. You're exactly right. And that, but you know, what bothers me is how we are still doing this kind of mess. And the thing about it is the way the name is structured, you would think that it's some kind of real powerful kind of movement. And that's why we as a people have to pay attention to this stuff and do our own research and investigation before we launch out there and get involved in stuff now. Because a lot of stuff is being done as a smokescreen. And that's what you have to be careful of. And we are not being careful of that. We just, Black Lives Matter. I call a spade a spade. That's some stuff with that. You know, and I think in terms of a community movement with a strong benefit of radical change, there are some things that need to be looked at. Even the Civil Rights Movement, it was the same thing. That was organizations in the Civil Rights Movement that was a little on the troubling side, you know, of things.
The bottom line boils down to, if it's not a movement based on the principles of Pan-Africanism
right.
and sovereignty, I ain't messing with it.
That's exactly right.
I just don't feel like it's anything that's going to be life-giving to me, myself. You right. know, everybody has a right to be a part of whatever movement, but I'm definitely not going to be a part of no movement with a member of the Freak Nation, the head of it, because I don't support homosexuality on no level whatsoever.
Yep,
you know what I mean? That's just how I feel.
I heard you say that yesterday. That's
good.
Right.
A homosexual leader, because, you know, they always want to throw up in your face Barry Rustin and James Baldwin and all of that. Hey, listen, Barry Rustin and James Baldwin wasn't leading no movement that I know of. They were part of a movement. They had a say-so in the movement. That don't mean that they was the out-front spokesman of the movement. So if you're the outspoken spokesperson mm-hmm. of the movement and you're a monkey man twisted sister, I can't roll with you.
Okay.
That's just straight up. I'm not even gonna play the game. I don't even care if what you're saying is right or wrong.
Right.
I'm just not gonna deal with it because you're not about what I believe in.
Right.
So we don't need to play that game. Now you have those out there who don't find that to be a problem. Well, I tell you like this. Sometimes you have to take a strong stance in the principle against something that's anti-human.
Yeah.
Now, you don't think it's anti-human, but hey, anything that ain't reproducing on the planet for the betterment of it, it ain't no good to me, baby. So listen, Dr. Rogers, let me let you go. So
okay.
Maybe you can take another caller. And, you know, I'll be giving you a call soon. It's just good to hear your voice.
Very
older,
good. Thank you
I'm
so
glad
much.
That you're doing well, brother.
Thank you, Brother
okay,
Jay. Thank you.
Low.
Okay.
All right, now,
all right,
Dr.
Peace.
Rogers.
Okay.
Put me on mute.
We're safe?
Put me on mute.
Oh, okay, I will. Okay. We've got 919-493. I'm not sure if you want to say something, caller. 919 area code 493. Okay, you just listening? All right, that sounds good. Okay. 919-591. Are you a caller? Would you like to say something or are you just listening? All right, just listening. Okay. I want to read something that comes from Richard Wright. Richard Wright was one of the idealists that said that if black folk are not producing art for the sake of change, kind of what Brother Jay was saying, if you're not dealing with a Pan-Africanist idea or some idea of change, then we don't need to be doing it. In a lot of cases, he wrote an essay called A Blueprint for Negro Writers. And that's a powerful document because what it does, it spells out, particularly for those Harlem Renaissance writers, you know, where they needed to be going and who needed to be writing about revolution and writing about change. Wright said this. He said, the Negro writer could not take his eyes off of the auction block. He never had a chance to. He could not stop thinking of lynching. He never had a chance to. The Negro writer had no choice in his subject matter. He could not select his own experience. And I think that is so powerful when we look at some of the things that were being done today, even in terms of art, music, literature. We're trying to take our eyes off of the block, the auction block. We're trying to take our eyes off of the lynching noose. But the world is not going to let us do that. They're going to keep throwing this stuff back in your face because they do believe you can't do anything about it. So the black face is not going to go anywhere. What has to go somewhere is how we are going to move forward as a people and begin to plant our feet. Like the song goes, the tree by the water. We're going to have to do that. And there's a lot of work ahead. In order to make that happen. It has to start in the classrooms of America. It has to start in the nursery schools of America. It has to start in the homes with the families, with the mothers, with the fathers. The fathers have got to come home, take their children by the hand, and work with them. That is the only way that we are going to be able to stop some of the mess that we see doing. No other culture will let you do that to their people. They will not let you make fun of their ancestors. They will not let you do any kind of idea. I remember I was reading something once that when Shakespeare attempted to write, and he called, for instance, the Jews, the Shylocks, and he's something, some other stuff he did in some of, I think it was called, it was The Taming of the Shrew. In his play, The Taming of the Shrew, he made fun and mockery at Jewish people. Well, he obviously did not change it, but it made a difference to who taught it and the fact that it would not be taught in certain universities because they wouldn't allow it in so case, and particularly where they were donors because they would withdraw their money. So we're going to have to create censorship systems where when people decide to do that, you hit them in the pocket, and that's how we can begin to stop the characters. We want to continue this discussion because there's another area that we definitely want to look at. And obviously, I did not have time to go all the way because we had the technical difficulty, but I think we've got it licked now. And we are going to next week, we're going to have a part two of this discussion. And I have a guest that wants to kind of talk about some research that he has done and some things that he has found that really augments this whole idea of what we're doing. Because history is replete with folk who understood what was happening with a lot of this. And their response to it, even in those hostile times, they rebelled against, you know, those kinds of ideology. But a lot of this, for instance, is rooted in the mixing of the races and the division and class within our own people, light skin, dark skin kind of stuff, middle class, lower class. Those are issues that also play into this very same discussion. And so next week we want to talk about how it does that and what is it that we need to be mindful of as we look at doing. So again, to all of our brothers and sisters who were willing to hang in there with me and we got this thing done, I really appreciate you. We're going to continue this next week. I want to close out with a song by the character that was in the Green Book, and the one of the classical pianist songs that he wrote that was has been used over the years, and this was the real work that he did and the kind of genius that he had that this film did not cover. So here is a closing out of his song. Thank you, and we'll see you again next week here at the Black Reality Think Tank. Thank you.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.